Good morning, everybody. You guys ready to start? I know it's beautiful. Get through this. Start our weekend here in a little bit. Sure, absolutely. Good for you. All right. So today we are going to try and finish up the American Civil War so that next week, as you're getting ready for your midterm, we'll do that with the study guide. I'll try to do that this afternoon and get that emailed to you. But as we're getting ready for that, I want us to kind of finish the 19th century so that when we get back, we can start on progressivism and start thinking about what this was the last third of the semester talking about what progressivism is and what it does for us as a people. So one of the things I'd like to do today as we're thinking about what the Civil War means, I want us to look at some of the varying views that we have in the reader. And I had asked you to look at George Fitzhugh's thing on sociology of the South. It's been a while since I asked you to look at that, but I want to come back to that. And I'd also like to look at the Cornerstone speech. And then we're going to read Sullivan Ballou's letter. And the question is essentially, what motivates people to fight in the American Civil War? What is it that gets them, well, puts their life on the line? Now, we've got roughly 94% of all Union soldiers are volunteers. So what is it that drove them to do this? What are their motivations? So we've been talking a lot in this class, understandably, as we're thinking about some of the great kind of intellectual questions. We've been thinking a lot about territorial expansion, religion, culture, slavery especially. But for the common soldier, these were not necessarily the questions they were asking. So when we're talking about just a common person, someone who was actually signed up to fight on the Union side or signed up to fight on the Confederate side, what is it that motivates them? And it's a pretty important question, because in the North, where we have a much freer society, we're going to tend to find that the views are fairly similar, but they're almost never about slavery, and they're almost never about race. So you'll find people from places like Hillsdale that sign up to fight because they want to end slavery, or people from Maine. But generally, you don't find, if you look through letters of Civil War soldiers, rarely do you find that they're fighting either for or against slavery. It's not the issue. And the same thing is true with Confederate soldiers. The vast majority of Confederate soldiers, who are generally poor whites, have absolutely no love of slavery at all. They don't like blacks either, so don't ever get that mixed up. But they don't love slavery, because imagine, why would they be fighting for slavery? They can't afford slaves. Slaves are competition for them. They are not going to be fighting for the officers. That's not what they're thinking about. So it would be very rare at any time during the American Civil War to just pick out at random two soldiers, one Confederate, one Union, and find that they're concerned about slavery. They may become concerned about slavery, but that's not the motivation why they fight. That's just not a part of their makeup. So we have to ask that, all right, well, what is it they're fighting for? One of the most interesting things that we find looking at the letters of soldiers over the long run, so whether it's 1861 or 1865, the two most common terms that we see in the letters of soldiers, and I'm obviously skipping conjunctions and things, but of unusual terms, terms that aren't always there, things that we might spot in their letters, they almost always argue that they're fighting for God, both sides. They believe that they're fighting not just for God, but in particular, they're fighting for a better republic. Again, North and South, they say this. They almost always describe what they're doing in Republican terms of sacrifice. And in particular, they're sacrificing themselves, not just for their family, but they almost always say that they're sacrificing themselves for George Washington. Even though this is many, many, many years after Washington's been dead, he's kind of the great symbol, and both North and South see themselves as living in line with Washington. So these are all the things we'll find of soldiers. But then we break it down a little bit more, again, looking for unusual and yet usual terms that pop up. And we find that in the North, almost every soldier at some point in his letters uses the term duty. We find that everywhere. Duty to my God, duty to my country, duty to my family, duty to my wife, duty to my kids. We see this over and over again, duty to George Washington. And in the South, where we would have the word duty, we have almost exactly the same word, but it's honor. And this is, why are you fighting? I'm fighting for the honor of my God or my country or my family or George Washington. And so those are the two most common words that we see over and over again in their letters. And let's just talk about that for a moment. What's this mean? I mean, what's duty and what's honor? What's the difference and what's the similarity? So I throw this out to you. What do you think in terms of, yeah, Chloe? Okay. Okay, this is excellent, right? So exactly as Chloe put this, number one, when we're thinking about something like honor, honor has to be earned. It has to be bestowed. So we seek honor, but we can't claim honor. Honor has to be given by somebody else. So I can say, yeah, maybe Chris has earned this or Chloe has earned this. I can bestow honor. And of course, we may judge. You know, if I said Marina has earned this, that may mean something to her. If Dr. Arne said it, it may mean something more to her. And that's understandable. The way that honor is bestowed, whoever's doing the bestowing, their character matters as well. And you know, think about if you had someone that you didn't really care about, a professor you didn't like that much, or someone on campus that you know, you respected but not that great. The honor they bestow on you is going to be proportionate to how you feel about them and what you think of them. So I think exactly in the way Chloe put it, we have to make sure that honor is something that we at least agree to what it is. There has to be some standard within the community. And yet there is an individual element to it, but not the individual who is being honored, but those who do the honoring. So that element is there. And Chloe, what did you say about duty? How did you put it? Okay, so much more individualistic, right? And in that sense, it would make sense when we're considering the North, and we think about the North being more individualistic, the South being more kind of communitarian, and the way that they look at this. And yet, at the same time, I think those distinctions are absolutely correct, but at the same time, they're pretty similar when we think about what they mean. Because the absence, even though honor and duty are different, their opposite is the same. And just think about that for a moment. What's the opposite? If I don't live up to honor, if I don't live up to duty, what have I brought upon myself and my community? I brought shame. And so shame is huge in the Civil War. We never want anybody to have shame thrust upon them. And that can be given in many ways. So I want to give you guys an example of how this works. And you'll have to forgive me for... It's funny, as I'm looking around, there's so many women in the class, which is great, don't get me wrong, but it's hard to use the example because there's so many women thinking about the Civil War. As I mentioned to you, during the Civil War, at least I think I mentioned this to you, there are a lot of women who participate, but they're not involved in the fighting generally. I mean, you're always going to find a strange story here or there where you have a woman soldier, but it's very rare. Most of the women are serving as nurses, they're helping, they keep... basically keep house in many ways on the field, and you'll have army of women, but they're not doing the same things men are doing in some ways. They're doing more important things, but they're doing different things. But what we find then, and this is why it gets a little bit complicated, just looking at the room and the bit of the gender imbalance, if we're thinking about why someone might fight in the Civil War, so imagine that one of the things we want to do in the Civil War is we always want a community to be fighting amongst themselves against others. Let me put that better, that didn't come out right. But we want to make sure, so if I went into the military now, or imagine when I was your age, if I went into the military, guy from Kansas farm town, one of the things that, say, the Marines would do to me instantly is they would take me and put me with someone from El Paso, or they might put me with someone from Hillsdale, or they might put me with someone from the Bronx. And part of what they're trying to do is they're trying to erase your character and then bring out a different character, which is all to the good. But it's an attempt to kind of homogenize us. In the Civil War, it was exactly the opposite. We want to make sure that if Josh and I sign up because we're from the same town, we want to make sure that we're fighting right next to each other on the battlefield.
So in the Civil War, the fact that you are fighting next to the person you grew up with is absolutely critical to how they saw the war effort proceed. So let's imagine this. Let's say, you guys will have to lower my age here for a moment, but let's say that I'm your age. And so Jared and Josh and I sign up first day, which at Hillsdale would have not been atypical. We sign up, and one of the things we're going to do right away is we're going to practice out on the quad. We're going to start drilling, having war games out there. We'll choose one of us to be the leader, which means we vote for our colonel, which is always very interesting. After you get beyond the level of colonel, colonel's in charge of 1,000 men, so a regiment. So here at Hillsdale, it would be the 2nd Michigan or the 4th Michigan or the 24th Michigan would be the main. And we vote a colonel in, and that tradition stays. We can also unvote him if the colonel behaves improperly. We could be in the middle of battle and we could unvote him. That happened more than once. But let's say, we'll forget that for a moment. But let's say that Jared and Josh and I are next to each other on the battlefield. And adrenaline's a funny thing. It's a very, very powerful thing, but it only lasts for about 5 to 6 minutes when you're in the middle of battle. You can get it back, but everybody knows that you're going to have this adrenaline rush that lasts a certain amount of time. You have to not let it carry you away. At the same time, you have to use it for your benefit. And a lot of war, of course, especially in the Civil War, is intimidation. So you can imagine, even though we may be standing across from each other, if I mount bayonet, if I'm told to mount bayonets and I charge, there's just something profoundly psychologically intimidating about that to the other side. Even though it may be the stupidest thing you could do at the moment from any objective standard, the fact you've put on bayonets in charge is just gonna freak out the other side, even if they have 10-to-1 advantage over you because they're thinking these guys are insane or whatever it is. Bayonet charges are actually very rare, but when they almost always work just because of the intimidation factor. So Josh and Jared and I are out on the field, and we get the call, okay, time to go. And whatever the order is, we hear the drum, we hear the bugle call, we hear the commander yell, the colonel yell, and we start marching. And maybe we'll go into double time, whatever it is, we're marching down the field. And all of a sudden, Jared just panics, which is not atypical in battle. One of the reasons you drill over and over again is so that these things become second nature. But Jared, suddenly his life matters more than anything else. And he doesn't really at that moment care about Josh or I, and so he runs back. And these guys were called coffee coolers or slackers. That's where the term slacker comes from. So the people who didn't fight in the middle of, and it was, if the three of us went into battle 10 times, it's not unexpected that at one point, each of us would have run away. That's not, it just happens, and everybody recognizes that. But the problem that happens with that, of course, is what if Josh, in the middle of battle then, because Jared is no longer standing next to him, Josh is hit and he's killed. I have to keep walking because the order is to keep marching. Josh has been shot and he's right there. And so I make it through the battle and I get back. Josh, of course, will always be a hero. There's just no question about that, even though he's not here anymore. He will always be remembered, and the community will remember him. Hillsdale will remember him. He'll have a good place in the cemetery. Maybe there'll be a statue about him. Almost certainly there'll be a parade. There'll be singing, something where the community remembers the greatness that was Josh. And nobody's going to speak ill of him. Even if Josh had been kind of a putz as a high school student, his death has made up for all. And he's now basically a demigod. And we respect that. But Jared was engaged in Nicole. And what happens in all of this is I write back to my fiance, and I say, hey, this is what happened. We were at Antietam. Josh gave his life for his country. It was an amazing moment. I could never live up to what Josh has given. Jared ran away. And what happens then? Well, imagine, I've grown up with Jared. He lived down the street from me. His mom used to discipline me when I was an idiot as a little kid. We've gone to church together. I know that his aunt is the teacher in town. Well, unless Jared makes up for what he had done wrong, he's done here. When he gets back to Hillsdale, nobody will hire him at all. Nicole is no longer engaged to him. In fact, Nicole is now dating Chris, right? Because he actually did well at another site. And that it's just, Jared's done. Now, he can make that up. In the next battle, he can do something heroic to make that up. There are always second chances. But this is why I want you guys to realize, and I don't think this is a bad thing, but this is why you only have to draft a few people in the Civil War. Because the community pressure is so powerful. And it just, it's everything. And once we get out there, once we're on the battlefield, I may not be fighting for honor or duty. That may be why I signed up. But at this moment, I'm fighting for Josh, or I'm fighting for Jared. And I'm fighting for Nicole, and I'm fighting for Marina, and I'm fighting for my wife and my kids. That's what I'm fighting for. And that, so we know that when people sign up for the military, they have a million reasons, many of them very good, sometimes practical, but very good. But on the battlefield, you're not fighting for that. You're fighting for the person next to you and the person back home. And that's just the psychology of it. So the community matters. And that's why we would never, ever pick somebody from a different community to fight with us. We don't know them. We may trust them. We're fighting right next to them. But what their reputation is not going to change the nature of Hillsdale itself. But what Jared and I and Josh do on the battlefield absolutely reflects our community. And it's either honor or shame. It's either we've either done our duty or we haven't. And that will last for a very long time. This is why you cannot run for office after the Civil War unless you had fought. Nobody's going to get into office, except Grover Cleveland's one major exception. But other than that, there's just no way. You're not going to get anything. You're not going to be elected head of the Kiwanis Club. You're not going to be president of Hillsdale College. Nothing. Unless you had done your duty. Now, your duty may have been small, but it still meant that you had done what you were supposed to do. Even if circumstances didn't give you glory, you didn't bring shame. So you have to be able to do that. Yeah, please.
But wouldn't that put communities at huge risk of almost being wiped out?
Yes.
Because like a lot of regiments, they get destroyed.
Absolutely. Right? And think about even Hillsdale men, actual Hillsdale College men on the first day of Gettysburg, as we talked about. They're wiped out in about 20 minutes. So you've got entire communities that are just devastated from this. And this happens all the time, and that's one reason that you don't put people together anymore, right? But there are other reasons too. There's psychological reasons for that. But the point I want to make, and this is an excellent comment and question, but the point I want to stress is that for these people, you are fighting as a community with the community next door to you and the community next door to them against those communities in the South. That's why it's both so horrific and also so glorious at the same time. Why the Civil War is such a brilliant tragedy, because of how near everybody is to one another. Now imagine how much so. So if you came from Hillsdale, the chances of you knowing a Southerner are pretty rare. But imagine if you came from Kentucky. I mean, you're probably fighting against your cousin. Or you may even, there are cases where you're fighting against your brother, maybe even against your dad. So those kinds of divisions are just huge, especially along the border. Here, it's a little less so. The farther away you get, obviously, the less it is, but still pretty amazing. Okay, so let's, I want to just point out a couple of things. Are there any other questions? Thanks for that. That was a great,
yeah. So if you were on a border and you had like heritage in the South, would you be a Confederate, or would you say no way?
Yeah, it's going to depend a lot. So we briefly talked about this, but if you're German, you almost always fight in favor of the Union. If you're a Native American, not an Indian, but an actual native-born American before German immigration, say you're a Missourian or something, you're Scotch-Irish, or it could go either way. And a lot would depend on some would depend on where your family went, and of course your family is going to be divided. So which part of your family do you follow? There's still a lot of old kin network. So we think, even at a place like Hillsdale, we still are fairly traditional about family. But even at a place like Hillsdale, our tradition of family is nothing compared to what it was 100, 150 years ago. And I still see this in my wife when we go down to Texas and we're in the county she grew up. Yeah, she can identify every neighbor. Doesn't matter where. You just drive out in the country. It's like, oh, that's Aunt Jean's place, and there's Billy Bob. And it's like, oh. And she doesn't, sometimes she doesn't even know what their position in the community is, but they're family and they're kin, and therefore they matter. So that, and in the South, of course, that maintains itself longer than in the North. True. For quite a while, too. So those kinship networks, everything matters. There are times where, think about really complicated, that we know that in the South, there were blacks who often owned other blacks. That's crazy to think about. And then, so what do they do in the war? Where do they fight? And we know that there were black soldiers who fought for the Confederacy. There were some who fought for the Union, obviously, but it's a really complicated issue. And a lot of it comes down to just who do you know and who do you trust? Who's your friend? And we know that there are a lot of places that will switch. So Confederate armies marching through today, you love the Confederacy. Next day, the Union Army marches through, you love the Union Army. So, same person. And partly, they're just saving their own skin, obviously, and trying to survive. So the worst place in America was the Shenandoah Valley, which was kind of the food supply for all of Washington, D.C., and Richmond, which meant everybody wanted it. But they kept raiding it, destroying it. They'd grow back, and then they'd raid it, destroy it. And, it's a civil war. It's hell. So, yeah. Yeah, Hannah.
When I was in the Army, we had to learn, seven terms that were, the core Army values.
Brought together.
Yeah.
Nice. Yeah. That is. Thanks for sharing that, Hannah. That is very interesting. Okay, good. Anything else on this? All right, so let's just open up briefly. And as I said, when we're talking about the elites, we're really not talking about slavery. So, and by elites, it's such a Marxist term, but I hope you guys know what I mean. The powerful, the rich, those who control political positions, and so on. So just briefly, let's turn to the sociology of the South, page 392. And somebody want to read here? It's not necessarily fun stuff to read, but thanks, Catherine. Right, it's at line 16.
But far the worst feature of modern civilization, which is the civilization of free society, remains to be exposed. Most labor-saving processes have probably lessened by one half in the last century the amount of work needed for comfortable support. The free laborer is compelled by capital and competition to work more than he ever did before, and is less comfortable. The organization of society cheats him out of his earnings, and those earnings go to swell the vulgar who are the only great ones today. These reflections might seem, at first view, to have little connection with Negro slavery, but it is well for us of the South not to be deceived by the tinsel glare and glitter of free society, and to employ ourselves in doing our duty at home and studying the past, rather than in insidious rivalry of the expensive pleasures and pursuits of men whose sentiments and whose aims are low, sensual, and godlike. Human progress consisted in moral and intellectual improvement, and there being no agreement of progress can never be accurately decided. We maintain that man has not improved because in all save the mechanic arts he reverts to the distant past for models to imitate, and he never imitates what he can excel. We need never have white slaves in the South because we have black ones. Our citizens, like those of Rome and Athens, are a privileged class. We should train and educate them to deserve the privileges and to perform the duties which society conferred on them. Instead, by a low demagogism, depressing their better excite their pride by reminding them that they do not fulfill the menial offices which white men do in other countries. Society does not feel the burden of providing for the few helpless paupers in the South. And we should recollect that here we have but half the people to educate, for half are Negroes, whilst at the North they provide to educate all. It is in our power to spite this last gun of the abolitionists. We should educate all the poor. The abolitionists say that it is one of the necessary consequences of slavery that it was not so in Athens and in Rome, and should not be so in the South. If we had less trade with and less dependence on the North, all our poor might be profitably and honorably employed in trade, professions, and manufacturers. Then we should have a rich and denser population. Yet we let marshal her in the way that she was going. The South is already aware of the necessity of a new policy and has begun to act on it. Every day more and more is done for education, for mechanic arts, manufactures, and internal improvements. We will soon be slavery of very little importance. The issue is made throughout the world on the general subject of slavery in the abstract. The argument has commenced.
One set of ideas will govern and control after a while the civilized world. Slavery will be everywhere abolished or everywhere be reinstituted. We think the opponents of practical existing slavery are as stopped by their own admission. Nay, that unconsciously, as socialists, they are the defenders and propagandists of slavery and have furnished the only sound arguments on which its defense and justification can be rested. We have introduced the subject of Negro slavery to afford us a better opportunity to disclaim the purpose of reducing the white man anywhere to the condition of Negro slaves here. It would be very unwise and unscientific to govern white men as you would Negroes. Every shade and variety of slavery has existed in the world. In some cases, there has been much of legal regulation, much restraint of the master's authority, and others, none at all. The character of slavery necessary to protect the whites in Europe should be much milder than Negro slavery, for slavery is only needed to protect the white man, whilst it is more necessary for the government of the Negro, even than for his protection. But even Negro slavery should not be outlawed. We might and should have laws in Virginia, as in Louisiana, to make the master subject to presentment by the grand jury and to punishment for any inhuman or improper treatment or neglect of this slave.
Okay, let's stop there, Catherine. Thanks. I know that was a lot and not necessarily pleasant stuff to read, but important for us to understand what's going on here. So what do you notice? Clearly, there's a division between white and black. Right, that's obvious. But what else is here that you noticed? What is Fitzhugh, who's a very famous public intellectual in the South, probably one of the most important public intellectuals in all of the South? What's he talking about in terms of free society? Santiago. Okay, so they've got this very deep classical heritage. Right, now imagine for a moment, and that's probably, I would assume for many of us in the classroom, that's a little bit appealing, not his argument, but at least appealing to Rome and to Athens. We kind of like that. Yeah, and think about how much we didn't like, or at least I professed my dislike, when we read O'Sullivan and he said, yeah, we have no need of the ancient world at all. Okay, well, let's go beyond that. So Santiago, you want to take it a little bit further? What's he drawing upon here?
Well, as far as like the idea of smaller republicanism, the rule of fewer, like the educated, and that the North may want like everybody to be like good, but at the same time, that doesn't seem to work. Why not just have our own little republic oligarchy?
Okay, so what is his society? Obviously, it's Republican, but is it something that we would recognize as a good thing aside from the race issue, which I assume all of us are going to be against? But what about the other thing, just regulating it all? Chris?
It seems that he's very pro on having everyone as equal as possible and developed as equally as possible, giving everyone the best chance that they can.
Okay, so we've got this movement of equality, which makes sense given everything else that we've seen. What does he think about, say, capitalist society? What's he think about capitalism? Alex?
Not a positive view.
Yeah, right. Yeah, and not, we can't quite say Marxist yet. It is definitely socialist, right? But it will be Marxist soon. It's just we're about 5-10 years too early for that, but it's coming. So I agree with you completely. But he does give us very socialist language. And what does capitalism do for us? Well, it basically makes us paupers. It's not the best thing for the progress of society. Society can only progress when we've essentially collectivized at some level and we've created equality among the races, that is, within the races, but not of the various races. So we have to have a subjugated one. And that's why, and I didn't have Catherine read this, but if you jump down to the next paragraph, the second to last line, well, the Southerner is the Negro's friend, his only friend. I'm not sure that's quite accurate, but there it is, right? I think Fitzhugh believes that. I mean, there seems to be some kind of true belief in that. Chloe.
Oh, I was just kind of going off what you were saying. It's interesting how he describes the more attitude as well. Saying that the Negroes we
did not. Yeah. Absolutely. And think about the argument here. Just if we can be really politically incorrect for a moment. You've got these savage people who are tribal in Africa. We've taken them out of that hell. And now we've actually given them clothes and housing. We've taught them Christianity. Of course they're better. Right? That's his argument. And yet they can't be equal. We are still, from his perspective, whites are still have some kind of duty to raise them up and yet to keep them subjugated at the same time. And that's obviously, it just gets extremely uncomfortable in the way that he's talking about this. Shiloh.
Well, in conjunction with that, for all his talk about equality, he's ultimately appealing to pride in the sense of superiority. Because he's saying that we need to excite white people's pride, remind them that they don't fulfill the other jobs that those other paupers do. And if he's really going for equality, then why is he trying to establish superiority?
So why do you think? Let's be as cynical, and I think we can be properly cynical here. What's the reason to make sure that whites all feel equal one to another? Why would they want to do that? Yeah.
Slavery is like not popular if people actually don't own them.
Exactly.
If you make the people that are poor seem like they're part of like an upper class system, they're more likely to continue.
Exactly. I mean, there's a very practical reason here that you want the poor whites, who are about 99% of the white population, you want to keep them angry at blacks too. So that's why, you know, we're going to find some very, very, and the racism, you know, we can easily put it on the South. The North can be just as racist. There's no question about that. But in the way that he's thinking about it here, we want to make sure that all the whites feel some kind of brotherhood with one another, so that they will keep blacks subjugated. Alex is absolutely right. I mean, that's how he's thinking about it. So let's jump forward a little bit then, and let's look at the Cornerstone speech and what we have from Alexander Steffens. And this is, if you look to page 486, and someone wants to read this, is starting on line 21 there, 486. So this is the Cornerstone speech. This is the speech given by Alexander Steffens, the vice president of the Confederacy, trying to explain why this is now the best government that's ever existed with the Confederate States of America. So Abby, would you mind reading? Starting on line 21, and just read, it looks like three paragraphs there, down to about line 14 on 487.
But not to be tedious in enumerating numerous changes for the better, allow me to allude to one other, though last not least. The new Constitution has put at rest forever all the agitating questions relating to our peculiar institution. American slavery as it exists among us, the proper status of the Negro and our form of civilization. This was the immediate cause of the last rupture and the present revolution. Jefferson in his forecast had anticipated this as the rock upon which the old Union would split. He was right. What was conjectured with him is now a realized fact. But whether he fully comprehended the great truth upon which the rocks stood and stand may be doubted. The prevailing ideas entertained by him and most of the leading statesmen at the time of the formation of the old Constitution were that the enslavement of the African was in violation of the laws of nature, that it was wrong in principle, socially, morally, and it was an evil they knew not well how to deal with, but the general opinion of the men of that day was that, somehow or other in the order of providence, the institution would be evasive and pass away. This idea, though not incorporated in the Constitution, was the prevailing idea of the time. The Constitution is true, secured every essential guarantee to the institution while it should last, and hence no argument can be justly urged against the constitutional guarantees thus secured, because of the common sentiment of the day. Those ideas, however, were fundamentally wrong. They rested upon the assumption of the equality of races. This was an error. It was a sandy foundation, and the government built upon it fell when the storm came and the wind blew. Our new government is founded upon exactly the opposite idea. Its foundations are laid. Its cornerstone rests upon the great truth that the Negro is not equal to the white man, that slavery, subordination to the superior race, is his natural and normal condition. This, our new government, is the first in the history of the world based upon this great physical, philosophical, and moral truth. This truth has been slow in the process of its development, like all other truths in the various departments of science. It has been so even amongst us. Many who hear me, perhaps, can recollect well that this truth was generally not generally admitted, even within their day. The errors of the past generation still clung to many as late as 20 years ago. Those of the North who still cling to these errors, with a zeal above knowledge, we justly denominate fanatics.
Nice job, Abby. Let's just think about this. This is astounding. Here's Stephen saying, oh yeah, by the way, we know the founders believed slavery was wrong, but they're wrong. I mean, this is amazing that you have this admittance. So, yeah, the founding did believe slavery would ultimately die and that we should have equality. Now we recognize that the founders were fools about this. So this is one of the, just for any of us who tend to be pro-Yankee, maybe sometimes overly so, this is just the best evidence you can find. They just totally shot themselves in the foot here. You know, because prior to this, this isn't just, oh, well, this is what the founders really wanted, da-da-da-da. They just admit, no, not at all what they wanted. And yet we've got it right. So that is, and clearly we're talking about one of the elite of the elites by doing this. So not the common soldier, but still vice president of the Confederacy, admitting this. He actually, by the way, Alexander Stephens becomes a pretty good guy after the war, really renounces a lot of his early views. He had always been a great friend of Abraham Lincoln's. In fact, he was one of Lincoln's best friends. And after the war, he becomes a what we would call a rock hard libertarian and really renounces all of his old views. So, but interesting, regardless, at this point, clearly he represents that deep racialist theory of the South. So, okay, that's we've still got a little bit of class left, but I'd like us to go outside if you guys don't mind. We'll go out to the Kresge Plaza out here, out to the Lincoln statue. And you're welcome to bring your stuff if you want. If you want to come back afterwards, that's fine. We'll probably be finishing up right at about 10 till. So maybe it'd be best for you guys to take your stuff now if you need to run to your next class. And we're going to be reading, if somebody would volunteer when we're out there to read Sullivan Blue's letter, I would very much appreciate it. And you guys do be, I know I don't need to tell you this is in kindergarten, but just make sure you're quiet on the way out since there are other classes going on.
Thank you. Hey, Matt.
Hey. We need a class outside.
Yeah, I saw you guys out there.
I saw you walk by. Figured you probably wondered what we were doing.
Yeah, I was wondering if I could stay up there or not, but I just figured out.
You know what? You'd get bored because you're going to have to hear it all again. So.